She kept it in her pocket, like a trophy. A piece of skull, someone's daughter, showed it to her friends, laughed about it, described the sound it made when she cut it away. She was 18 years old. January 12, 1995, Knoxville, Tennessee. Four teenagers walked into the woods together that night. Only three walked out. And the one who stayed behind died, begging for her life for 30 minutes straight. They called her the youngest woman on death row, Krista Pike. But before she was a killer, she was just a girl. A broken girl in a broken home, with a jealous heart and a box cutter in her hand. Before she became a monster, she was a victim too. That's what makes this story so uncomfortable. Because if we're being honest, most of us want our monsters simple. Pure evil. Born wrong. It's easier that way, isn't it? But Krista Pike's story isn't simple. It's messy. It's tragic. It's infuriating. And tonight, we're going to sit with that discomfort. We're going to ask the question nobody wants to answer. What creates a monster? Is it born or is it made? One wound, one abandonment, one failure at a time. This is Among Monsters, and tonight we meet Krista Gail Pike, the youngest woman on death row, the girl who became a nightmare. Welcome to Among Monsters. I'm your host, Maya Vale. Each week we descend into the shadows where the human mind breaks. We explore killers, the cults, the monsters who walk among us. And we ask not just what they did, but why. Because understanding darkness doesn't excuse it. It just helps us recognize it before it's too late. Tonight's episode, Krista Pike, the youngest woman on death row. March 10th, 1976, West Virginia. Krista Gail Pike is born into a world already cracking at the seams. Her mother, Krista Hansen, is an alcoholic. Her father, well, he's barely in the picture. By the time Krista could form memories, she was already bouncing between homes, between relatives who didn't want her, between beds that never felt safe. Imagine being a child and learning very early that you're unwanted. I want you to picture something. A little girl, maybe 7 years old, she's watching her mother drink herself unconscious again. The apartment reeks of stale beer and cigarette smoke. There's no food in the fridge. No one's coming to check on them. She's learned not to cry because no one comes when she does. She's learned that love is conditional, temporarily dangerous. She's learned that the people who are supposed to protect you are often the ones who hurt you most. Child psychologists have a term for this: complex developmental trauma. It rewires the brain, changes how you process fear, attachment, empathy. It's not an excuse for violence, but it's a factor. A crack in the foundation. By age 12, Krista was already showing signs: aggression towards other kids, cruelty to animals, a major red flag. She was cutting herself, acting out sexually, using whatever drug she could find. Teachers noticed. Social workers noticed. School counselors noticed. She was evaluated multiple times. But here's the thing about the system in rural West Virginia. In the late 80s, early 90s, noticing isn't the same as helping. She fell through the crack after crack, moved between foster placements, ran away, came back, each time a little more broken, a little more angry, a little more convinced that the world didn't give a damn about her. And you know what? She wasn't wrong. By age 17, Krista had dropped out of school, no diploma, no job prospects, no family support system. She was using drugs regularly, marijuana, alcohol, whatever she could get her hands on. She was angry, violent, and completely untethered. That's when someone suggested Job Corps. It's a federal program, last chance for kids with no options. They give you vocational training, a place to live, 3 meals a day. For kids like Krista, it's literally the end of the line. Make it work or fall into nothing. In 1994, Krista enrolls in Job Corps Center in Knoxville, Tennessee. On paper, hope, a fresh start. A chance to learn computer skills, get a job, build something. But for Krista Pike, it's where she meets the two people who will define the rest of her life. Tydrell Shipp, the boy who will become her boyfriend, her accomplice, her co-conspirer, and Colleen Sleamer, the girl who will become her victim. It's strange, isn't it, how fate works. If Krista had enrolled a month earlier or later, if she'd been assigned to a different dorm, if she'd never met Tydrell, would Colleen Sleamer still be alive? Would Krista be on death row? We'll never know. What we do know is this. Job Corps centers are pressure cookers. You got hundreds of teenagers from broken homes, all with trauma, all with nowhere else to go, all living on top of each other in tight quarters. It's not a question of if things will explode, it's when. Picture it. Cramped dorms, 4, sometimes 6 girls to a room, shared bathrooms, group showers, mandatory classes during the day, teenage hormones, territorial disputes, racial tension, romantic drama, in high school, but with no parents, no escape, and everyone's got something to prove. If someone like Krista, someone who'd spent her whole life feeling abandoned, rejected, invisible, attachment becomes everything. When she finally found someone who paid attention to her, who made her feel wanted, she wasn't going to let anyone take that away without a fight. Enter Tydrell Shipp, 17 years old, from Kentucky, troubled background, just like Krista, small, weary, with dark eyes and a dangerous edge. And for reasons neither of them probably understood, they clicked. This wasn't puppy love. This was two damaged kids finding each other and mistaking intensity for intimacy. Krista became obsessed. Tydrell became her entire world, her identity, her reason. If he left, she'd be abandoned again. And after a lifetime of abandonment, that was unthinkable. And when she thought someone was trying to take him away from her, when jealousy started to fester in her mind like an infection, the monster woke up. Colleen Sleamer. I want you to know her name. Not as a victim, but as a person. She was 19 years old from Jacksonville, Florida. She had dreams, goals, and a future. Colleen enrolled in Job Corps to learn computer skills. She wanted to be a secretary, maybe work her way up to office management. Nothing flashy, just a life. Stability, something better than what she'd known. By all accounts, she was friendly, easygoing, the kind of person who'd share her cigarettes, loan you $5, listen to your problems. She wasn't looking for drama. She wasn't competing with anyone. But Krista Pike decided Colleen was her enemy. And once Krista decided something, there was no reasoning with her. It started small. Krista noticed Colleen talking to Trudell in the cafeteria. Just talking, maybe laughing at a joke, maybe asking to borrow a pencil, completely innocent. But with Krista's mind, Colleen was flirting. Colleen was trying to steal him. Colleen was the threat. And the more Krista watched, the more convinced she became. This is what jealousy does, especially in someone's already unstable. It distorts reality, creates narratives that don't exist. Every smile became seduction. Every conversation becomes betrayal. The jealous mind is always collecting evidence, and it's never wrong. Krista started obsessing. She'd watch Colleen constantly, follow her around campus, interrogate Trudell about every interaction. The other girls in the dorm noticed. They said Krista talked about Colleen constantly, always negative, always angry. Then the talk got darker. Krista started telling people she wanted Colleen dead. She described how she'd do it, where she'd do it, what tools she'd use. And here's the chilling part. She wasn't venting. She wasn't joking. She was planning. Multiple witnesses later testified that Krista openly discussed killing Colleen. Some got uncomfortable and left. But no one reported it. No one told a counselor, a supervisor, campus security. Why? Because teenagers talk tough all the time. Because they didn't think she was serious. Because intervening is uncomfortable, and it's easier to just not. Meanwhile, Trudell was feeding into it. He told Krista that, yeah, Colleen was weird. Yeah, she was probably into him. Yeah, they should do something about it. Whether he actually believed Krista would kill someone, or whether he was just playing into her delusions, we'll never know. But he never stopped her. And that made him just as culpable. January 12, 1995, Friday night. Most students were relaxing after classes, watching TV, playing cards, Krista Pike has made a decision. Tonight is the night. She recruited Shadala Peterson, another student, to help. Shadala later claimed she didn't know what was going to happen, but testimony suggests otherwise. She knew something was planned. She knew it was bad. She went anyway. Around 8 p.m., Krista, Todaro, and Shadala approached Colleen in a common area. Krista, friendly, casual, "Hey, you want to go smoke some weed with us? We're going to walk over to the Egg campus. It's quiet over there." And Colleen, who probably just wanted friends, who probably felt relieved to be included by the popular couple, who probably never imagined what was coming, said yes. Just like that. "Yeah, sure." A simple decision. The last decision she'd ever make freely. They walked together through campus, past other students heading to dinner, past the library, past buildings with lights on and people inside who could have helped. Four teenagers on what looked like a casual evening stroll. The temperature was dropping. January in Tennessee, probably mid-30s. Colleen might have pulled her jacket tighter. Maybe she asked where exactly they were going. Maybe Krista made a joke, kept the mood light. They reached the agricultural campus. Acres of experimental farms, animal enclosures, and beyond that, woods. Dense, isolated woods. The kind of place students went to party or hook up because no one from campus security bothered to patrol out there. They kept walking, away from the lights, away from the buildings, away from help. The path got rougher, roots and rocks. The moon was out, but the tree canopy blocked most of the light. Colleen had no idea. She was just walking, maybe talking about classes, maybe complaining about her roommates, maybe laughing at something Tridal said. She was 19 years old, and she had no idea that in less than an hour, she'd be dead. They reached a clearing, secluded, dark, perfect. And then that's when Krista Pike turned on her. Before I continue, I need to say something. What I'm about to describe is brutal. It's disturbing. If you need to pause this episode, do it now. If you're listening while driving or in public, maybe come back to this when you're in a better space. This isn't entertainment. This isn't shock value. This is what happened to a real person. Her name was Colleen Sleamer. She had a family who loved her, friends who miss her, and she deserves to have her story told with respect. Shadala Peterson stayed back near the edge of the clearing. She later claimed she tried to stop what happened, but witness testimony and her own statements suggest she was a culprit. At minimum, she watched. At worst, she participated. Krista and Shadala surrounded Colleen. At first, nothing seemed wrong. Maybe there was conversation. Maybe Colleen sensed something was off. Prey instinct. We all have when we're in danger. Then, without warning, Krista attacked. She pulled out a box cutter, a tool she'd taken from her class. Small, sharp, perfect for cutting through cardboard or skin. Colleen tried to run. She was ambushed, confused, terrified. But Trudell grabbed her, held her, and Krista started cutting. Colleen screamed. Of course she did. She begged. Why are you doing this? What did I do? I didn't do anything to you. And Krista's response, according to later testimony, was simple, cold, definitive. Because I just want to. For 30 minutes, Krista and Trudell tortured Colleen Sleamer. They used the box cutter. They used rocks. They used chunks of asphalt from a broken up path. They used their fist. Colleen fought back as long as she could. She begged for her life again and again. She promised she hadn't done anything wrong. She pleaded for mercy that would never come. At some point during the attack, Krista carved a pentagon into Colleen's chest. Not quickly, deliberately. Some reports suggest she was interested in Satanism, but investigators believe it was more likely about power, about marking her victim, about making it personal. Then Krista picked up a large chunk of asphalt, jagged, heavy, and she brought it down on Colleen's skull again and again and again. Long after Colleen stopped moving, long after she stopped breathing. Medical examiners would later count over 100 wounds on Colleen's body. Defensive wounds on her hands, where she tried to protect herself. Deep lacerations, blunt force trauma. Her skull was fractured in multiple places. But Krista Pike wasn't done. Even with Colleen's lifeless body at her feet, even with blood on her hands and clothes, she wanted more. She took out the box cutter one more time, and she cut away a piece of Colleen's skull, roughly into 2 inches in diameter, a souvenir, proof of what she'd done. She wrapped it in a cloth, put it in her jacket pocket, and then they just walked away, back through the woods, back across campus, back to their dorms, like nothing had happened. Krista showered, changed clothes, and then she started bragging. She showed people the piece of skull. She described what she'd done in graphic detail. She laughed about the sounds Colleen made, the way she begged. She was proud. This wasn't a crime of passion. It wasn't self-defense. It wasn't even a fight that went too far. This was premeditated murder, torture, sadism, and Krista Pike revealed in it. Colleen Sleamer's body was found the next morning by a group of students cutting through the woods. They thought it was a prank at first, a Halloween decoration left over from months before. Then they got closer. Colleen was laying in the clearing where she died, frozen, broken, alone. The medical examiner later said she'd probably been conscious for most of the attack. She knew what was happening to her. She was 19 years old. She had her whole life ahead of her. She wanted to work with computers, maybe get married someday, have kids, grow old, all the normal things we all want. Instead, she died terrified and in agony. In the cold Tennessee woods, killed by someone who didn't even really know her. Someone who invented a reason to hate her and then acted on it with unimaginable cruelty. Colleen Sleamer deserved so much more than this. We owe her that much. to remember her as more than a victim, as a person, as someone who mattered. January 13, 1995, less than 24 hours after the murder, word was already spreading through Job Corps like wildfire. Students were whispering in the hallways, pointing at Krista, asking each other, "Did you hear what she did?" Krista couldn't keep her mouth shut. She was showing off her trophy, the piece of Colleen's skull, to anyone who'd look. Some people were horrified. Some didn't believe her. Some laughed nervously, not knowing what else to do. But one student did the right thing. They called campus security. Campus security called the Knoxville Police Department. And suddenly, what Krista thought was her moment of triumph became her downfall. Detectives arrived within hours. They interviewed students. The stories were consistent. Krista had been threatening Colleen for weeks. Multiple people heard her say she was going to kill her. And now Colleen was dead. They brought Krista in for questioning. At first, she denied everything. Then she admitted being there, but blamed Trudell. Then, when pressed, she confessed, in detail, with disturbing pride. But the smoking gun? When they searched her belongings, they found it. The piece of Colleen's skull, still in her jacket pocket, exactly where she'd put it. The evidence was overwhelming. Witness testimony from a dozen students. The physical evidence. Krista's own confession. Trudell's confession. Shadala's cooperation. This was one of the most open and shut murder cases investigators had ever seen. March 1996, 14 months after the murder, the trial begins. Krista Pike sits in court, just 20 years old now. She's wearing a blue dress. Her lawyers attempt to make her look innocent, young, sympathetic. The prosecution is relentless. They present the evidence piece by piece. Photographs of the crime scene, so graphic that some jurors cry. The medical examiner's testimony about Colleen's injuries, the souvenir, the bragging. They paint Krista as cold-blooded, jealous, sadistic. Someone who planned this murder, executed it with shockingly, brutally, and then celebrated it. The prosecutor tells the jury, this wasn't a crime of passion. This was torture. This was evil. But the defense has a different story to tell. They bring in Krista's childhood, the abuse, the neglect, the drugs, her mother's alcoholism, the string of foster homes. They argue she's not a monster, she's a broken child. Expert witnesses testify about her mental state, borderline personality disorder, possible schizophrenia, a history of self-harm and discussion. They show brain scans, psychological evaluations, IQ tests showing developmental delays. The defense psychologist tells the jury that Krista's brain quite literally works differently, that years of trauma rewired her natural pathways, that she can't process empathy the way most people do, that she was in many ways a child soldier in a war she didn't choose. They argue she was manipulated by Trudell, that he was older, more experienced, more dominant in the relationship, that Krista was desperate for love and would have done anything to keep him. That she wasn't the mastermind. She was a tool. But here's the problem with that defense. The evidence shows Krista was the primary aggressor. She was the one who threatened Colleen for weeks. She was the one who planned it. She was the one who kept the souvenir. She was the one who bragged. The prosecution's rebuttal is devastating. They acknowledge Krista had a hard life, but millions of people suffer abuse and don't become murderers. Trauma explains behavior. It doesn't excuse it. And Krista Pike didn't just kill Colleen Sleamer. She tortured her. The jury deliberates. Hours turn into days. This is a death penalty case. The stakes couldn't be higher. They're deciding whether a 20-year-old woman lives or dies. March 30th, 1996, the jury returns. Guilty. First-degree murder. Premeditated. With aggravating circumstances. But that's just the conviction. Now comes the sentencing phase. Does Krista Pike get life in prison or death? The prosecution argues for death. The brutality, the torture, the lack of remorse, the bragging. They say Krista Pike is beyond rehabilitation, that she's dangerous, that justice demands the ultimate punishment. The defense begs for life. They bring in Krista's family, what's left of it. Her mother testifies, slurring slightly, about her own failures. They argue that executing someone for crimes committed at 18 is cruel. That there's still hope for redemption. The jury deliberates again, and then death. At 20 years old, Krista Gayle Pike becomes the youngest woman sentenced to death in the United States in nearly a century. The youngest woman on death row. Jadal Shipp, tried separately, receives life in prison without parole. He's eligible for parole in 2028. Shadala Peterson, who testified against both them, received 6 years probation and is released after serving a fraction of that time. Three teenagers walked out of those woods that night. Only one faces execution. Tennessee Prison for Women, a sprawling facility in Nashville that houses the state's only death row for women. This is where Krista Pike has lived for the past 28 years. Death row is different from general population. You're in a 6x9 cell, 23 hours a day, 1 hour for recreation. Which usually means walking in circles in a small concrete yard. No contact with other inmates except shouting through walls. Imagine that. 23 hours a day for 28 years. That's over 245,000 hours in a space smaller than most people's bathrooms. No privacy, constant surveillance, waiting. But according to reports from prison staff and court documents, Krista Pike didn't exactly make the best of her situation. Within the first year, she had multiple disciplinary infractions, assault, threats against staff, violent outburst. She was described as manipulative, would try to put guards against each other, would file frigorous grievances, would befriend inmates and then turn on them, even behind bars, even facing execution. Krista Pike remained dangerous. And then in 2001, something happened that shocked even seasoned correctional officers. Krista Pike tried to escape. Her co-conspirator was Patricia Jones, another woman on death row for killing an elderly couple. Together, they hatched a plan. It was desperate. It was violent. And honestly, it was never going to work. The plan was simple in its brutality. Attack a guard during recreation time. Knock her unconscious. Steal her uniform and keys. Fight their way through the prison. Somehow, get past multiple security checkpoints, armed guards, and razor wire. Just walk out. It's the kind of plan that might work in a movie. In real life, it was suicide by proxy. They made it as far as approaching the guard. Then other staff noticed something was off. Alarm sounded, backup arrived. The escape attempt lasted maybe 90 seconds before both women were subdued. Krista was charged with attempted murder of a corrections officer and conspiracy to commit escape. More time added to the sentence she'd likely never live to complete anyway. But it showed that even years after Colleen's murder, even facing death, Krista Pike was still willing to hurt people to get what she wanted. But Krista's real battle wasn't in the prison yard. It was in the courts. Appeal after appeal, motion after motion, her lawyers fighting to keep her alive, the state fighting to execute her. The appeals have been extensive. Claims of ineffective counsel at trial, arguments that her mental illness wasn't properly considered, challenges to Tennessee's death penalty procedures, questions about executing someone for crimes committed at 18. Some of these arguments have merit. The Supreme Court has ruled multiple times since Krista's conviction about juvenile sentencing. There's extensive research now about brain development, how the prefrontal cortex, responsible for impulse control and decision making, isn't fully developed until the mid-20s. Krista was 18, legally an adult, but neurologically still developing. Does that matter? Should it matter? The courts have gone back and forth on this question for decades. But here's the other side. Krista was old enough to plan a murder, old enough to torture someone for 30 minutes, old enough to keep a souvenir and brag about it. At what point does age stop being a mitigating factor? 2011, the Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals upholds her conviction. In 2014, the Tennessee Supreme Court denies her appeal. In 2016, federal appeals begin. Each time, her lawyers argue, each time, the courts say no. In 2020, the state of Tennessee sets an execution date, August 19th. For the first time in 24 years, Krista Pike faces the very real possibility that her wait is over. Her lawyers file emergency appeals. They argue about lethal injection protocols, about COVID-19 restrictions affecting her ability to meet with counsel, about new evidence of brain damage from childhood abuse. The execution is stayed, delayed. Krista Pike gets more time. But how much more? That's the question no one can answer. As of now, late 2024, Krista Pike remains on death row. She's 48 years old. She's been in prison for nearly 30 years, more than half her life. She's outlived her victim by 29 years and counting. She spends her days in that 6x9 cell, reading, writing letters, filing appeals, waiting, always waiting for a pardon that will never come, for a miracle, for the day the state of Tennessee finally carries out her sentence. In a strange way, death row is its own form of torture. The waiting, the uncertainty, knowing that someday, maybe next month, maybe next year, maybe a decade from now, you'll be strapped to a gurney and given a lethal injection. Living, but not really alive. Existing in limbo. Maybe that's its own kind of justice. Maybe it's just cruel. I don't know anymore. So here we are, nearly 30 years later. And I'm left with the same question I started with. What creates a monster? I've told you Krista's story, her childhood, the abuse, the neglect, the crime, the sentence. And maybe you're sitting here thinking, she's a monster, pure evil. She deserves everything she got. And you know what? Maybe you're right. But Krista Pike was also a child once, a little girl who needed love and got abandonment, who needed safety and got chaos, who needed help and got nothing. She was failed by every system designed to protect children. Does that excuse what she did? Absolutely not. Nothing excuses the torture and murder of Colleen Sleamer. Nothing erases those 30 minutes of agony. Nothing gives back the life that was stolen. Nothing heals her family's grief. But understanding isn't excusing. And if we can't ask why someone becomes capable of such horror, if we can't examine the conditions that creates killers, how do we prevent the next one? Here's the uncomfortable truth. Monsters aren't born fully formed. They're made. Slowly, painfully, through years of damage that compounds and festers until something fundamental breaks inside. Krista Pike was abused. Krista Pike was neglected. Krista Pike showed every warning sign imaginable. And nobody helped her. Not really. Not enough. And then Krista Pike became an abuser herself. She chose violence. She chose cruelty. She chose to torture an innocent person to death. Those were her choices, not her mother's, not the system's, hers. So we can hold both truths, that Krista was a victim and a monster, that she deserved better, and that she deserves her punishment, that she was failed by society, and that she was failed by herself. I think we have to, because we only see her as a monster. We missed the opportunity to prevent the next Krista Pike. We missed all the warning signs. We missed the intervention points where someone could have changed this trajectory. But if we only see her as a victim, we absolve her of responsibility. We erase Colleen Sleamer's humanity. We suggest that childhood trauma is destiny, which is an insult to the millions of abuse survivors who never hurt anyone. The reality is messy. Krista Pike is both victim and perpetrator, both broken child and sadistic killer. And that's hard to accept. We want our villains simple, our monsters pure, but real evil is almost always more complicated. I think about all the intersections where this could have been different. If Krista had been removed from her mother's care earlier, if she'd gotten real mental health treatment instead of being shuffled through the system, if someone at Job Corps had taken her threats seriously If Trudal had walked away, if Shadala had called for help, but none of that happened. And Colleen Sleamer paid the price for every failure along the way. I don't have easy answers. I won't give you a neat resolution for everything that makes sense, because it doesn't. Two lives were destroyed on that January night. Colleen's ended. Krista's changed into something unrecognizable. Maybe the best we can do is remember both of them as human. Colleen Sleamer, who deserved to live, who deserved to achieve her dreams, who deserved to grow old, who deserved so much more than she got. And Krista Pike, who became something monstrous, but who started as a child, who deserved protection, who deserved intervention, who deserved a chance to become something other than what she became. Can we mourn what was lost in both of them? Can we demand justice for Colleen while also acknowledging that the system had failed Krista? Can we hold space for complexity in the world that demands simplicity? I think we have to try. Krista Pike sits in a cell tonight, still waiting, still the youngest woman on death row. And Colleen Sleamer remains forever 19, frozen in those Tennessee woods. Two lives, both destroyed. One cold January night, and 30 years later, we're still trying to understand why. You've been listening to Among Monsters. I'm Maya Vale. Tonight we walk through the life and crimes of Krista Pike, a story that refuses easy answers and challenges us to sit with profound discomfort. A story about jealousy, violence, systematic failure, and the question of whether someone can be both victim and monster. If this episode made you think, made you question your assumptions, or made you feel something you didn't expect to feel, that's exactly what it should do. These stories aren't just about the past. They're about how we understand violence, justice, rehabilitation, and humanity itself. I know this was a heavy one. Stories about real violence, real victims, real consequences always are. If you need to take a break, compress, talk to someone, please do. Taking care of your mental health isn't weakness, it's wisdom. If you want to support this show and help me keep telling these important stories, the best thing you can do is leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Share this episode with someone who appreciates deep dives into true crime and human psychology. Subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you want to continue the conversation, find me on social media. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Krista Pike's case. Do you think the death penalty is appropriate here? Do you think her childhood trauma should have resulted in a different sentence? Do you believe in rehabilitation for someone capable of this level of violence? There are no wrong answers, just honest, wrestling with difficult questions. What happens when a child is raised by a killer? When the only role model you have is someone who taught you that violence is love? Can you break free from that programming, or are you doomed to repeat it? Until next time, remember, the scariest monsters aren't hiding in the dark. They're not lurking under your bed or waiting in abandoned buildings. The scariest monsters walk among us. They sit next to us in class. They live in our neighborhoods. They look at us. Sometimes they even look like scared, broken children who just need someone to help them before it's too late. Stay safe, stay aware, stay curious about the darkness, but never let it consume you. And maybe, just maybe, stay a little more human. Thank you for walking into the shadows with me.